Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. British police say the body of a bomber was aboard the bus blown up in last week's terror attacks, and that three other bombers also died in the transit attacks. The bus bomber's identification apparently led authorities to raid several homes in northern England today. The confirmed death toll in last Thursday's attacks now reaches upwards of 52 people, with more than 700 injured. Kevin Cullen of the Boston Globe is in London. We spoke to him a short while ago and asked first about the discovery of the bus bomber.
I just spoke with somebody in the anti-terrorism here at Scotland Yard, and they said they haven't made that determination yet because the witness accounts they got of somebody fiddling with a bag or going repeatedly into the bag that was on the bus, it's still unclear to them whether that was a person who was triggering the device or somebody who was just anxious and trying to make sure that the device was not going to go off. They are working under the presumption that that person was also meant to be on a tube train, but for some reason or other, his bomb did not detonate.
Well, tell us more about the raids in Leeds, a major town about 185 miles north of London. It's said that the discovery of this body that might have been a bomber on the bus led police to Leeds.
There was a controlled explosion carried out by police. It's pretty routine police procedure here when they have a bag or something that they think is suspect, they will blow it up in case it contains explosives. But we haven't been told that there were explosives. I think if they blew up something that had explosives in it, that would have leveled the house. So my sense is they probably weren't explosives.
We understand about 500 people were evacuated from the area. The streets cordoned off. Raids began at about 6:30 a.m. British time. Tell us more about Leeds.
It's a northern industrial city. It's a mad about its football team. It's also a very diverse city. A lot of mix, a lot of people. There would be a substantial population of people from Arab or Asian backgrounds in that area. So, you know, from the beginning, the police have been working on the premise that the bombers were homegrown fundamentalists, Islamic fundamentalists, and that it would be likely that they are probably British nationals who are sympathetic to Al-Qaeda but not necessarily members of Al-Qaeda or not necessarily in touch with members of Al-Qaeda.
Well, in fact, other terrorism analysts are saying the same thing. One, Loretta Napoliani, estimates that the attacks cost between $10,000 and $15,000, relatively inexpensive, and these kinds of smaller attacks avoid having to make international bank transfers. But on the other hand, the New York Times is reporting that the 10-pound bombs contained military-quality, high-grade explosives, which could mean someone from outside of England.
It could. It could also be Semtex. And clearly, this Semtex was used, you know, extensively by the Irish Republican Army during its long campaign of bombing here in the U.K. It's possible some of that could fall there. The other thing, it's possible, you know, some of this stuff could come from the Balkans, which is basically a weapons supermarket and has been basically since the fall of the Soviet Union. So it could come from anywhere. There's an awful lot of that weaponry to be had, but then, of course, it says how do you get it into the U.K.?
Kevin Cullen of the Boston Globe speaking to us from London, which we know is perhaps one of the most wired cities in the world in terms of video cameras. How are investigators using that information? Is there any news from there?
Well, clearly that was one. I think the investigation now has moved beyond that if they have a house that they're raiding. But the other thing, the police have acknowledged privately that the camera on the bus was not working. So they do not have a picture. They do not have a picture of the bomber on the bus.
The alleged bomber on the bus. Well, Kevin, one last thought. As you are there in London, we hear that bicycle sales are going through the roof.
You know, I have noticed the little mini ones, the ones that you can kind of fold up. I have noticed more of them in the last couple of days. And yet, you know, I rode the tube and the buses extensively for the last 3-4 days and did not. According to London Underground, there's been a slight dip in the ridership on the tube, but there's been no change on the buses. I asked a fellow yesterday if he was making a defiant statement to the bombers, and he said, no, I'm going to work.
Kevin Cullen of the Boston Globe speaking to us from London. Kevin, thanks as always.
Okay, thanks, Robin.
And again, British police reporting just moments ago that four bombers have been killed in the attacks last week. It's not clear, however, if the bomber aboard a bus meant to detonate his explosive. Well, the latest Gallup poll gives President Bush a 3-point jump in approval ratings following last week's attacks in London. His numbers had been lagging at the end of June when even his well-publicized speech about Iraq did not appear to affect public opinion. Well, this doesn't surprise Duke University professor Christopher Gelpe, a political scientist whose research on public opinion has been used and touted by the Bush administration. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you for having me.
Professor, what is the overarching thought, based on your research, the most important factor in shaping public perception?
Well, what we found is that the most important single factor in determining whether people are willing to support an ongoing military operation is whether or not they believe that mission is likely to succeed.
Well, we understand that you and your colleague Peter Fever think that there are two basic questions. One, as you said, is the war winnable? The other, was the decision to go to war the right one? Why isn't that question weighing as heavily?
I think it's because we are now in Iraq, and so the question of whether or not we should be there, while it clearly generates a good deal of anger, especially some partisan anger, I think the fact is that we're there now, and so what we see is most respondents sort of looking forward and saying, okay, now that we're in Iraq, should we stay there or not? And that's more of a prospective judgment of are we going to be able to succeed in some way there? And if so, then even if you think, well, we shouldn't have been in Iraq to begin with, if you think the mission can succeed, then you're less likely to think we should pull out now.
But, Professor, doesn't the president walk a tricky path if he shows too much confidence in the face of negative news coming out of Iraq? He loses credibility. And I mean, right now you can listen to some conservative radio talk show hosts and hear them demanding that the troops leave.
Our research certainly doesn't indicate that simply by standing up and saying we're going to win that the president can indefinitely rally public support. I do think that showing sort of confidence in the face of some negative news does help to prop up public support. I think if you contrast, for example, the way the American public responded to the atrocities in Fallujah, to the way the public responded to the Black Hawk Down incident, for example, in Somalia, I think a lot of that difference has to do with presidential leadership and presidential resolve. Mm. But at the same time, if the president continues to simply sort of put a happy face on everything, I think the president loses credibility. And we saw some of that, for example, if you look back farther into Vietnam, where we have the sort of 5 o'clock follies of these news briefings that were basically, you know, started to be taken as fictional because no one would believe the government anymore.
Well, as a matter of fact, let's talk more about that because we know you've studied past wars, including Vietnam. And what else did we learn? Because I thought the takeaway for you from Vietnam was that the war might have been winnable if the leaders showed more resolve.
What we can say for sure is that the public turned against the war and became unwilling to tolerate the casualties of the war once they came to the conclusion that the mission could not succeed. If the administration had been able to persuade the public that the mission could succeed, I think things could have been different.
Right, because as you pointed out in Vietnam, once the language of the leaders is so contrary to the images coming into your living room, you know, there's a credibility gap.
Right. While our leaders have some leeway to frame and reframe issues for the public, as, for example, the Bush administration has clearly reframed the war in Iraq, at the same time, I don't think they have sort of a infinite flexibility. Again, going back to Vietnam, the Johnson administration, I think, simply was not able to overcome the media's portrayal of the Tet Offensive.
What's your assessment of how President Bush is shaping public opinion?
I do think that there are ways in which they can frame success that they're not doing. For example, we're hearing today about this plan for troop withdrawals. You know, there's another leaked British memo. And instead of having that whole discussion be framed as how quickly can we pull out, seems to me if the Bush administration wants to maintain support for the war, they ought to be using withdrawal as sort of benchmarks for success. Those sort of benchmarks of, you know, slowly turning over security forces to the Iraqis are the kinds of benchmarks of success that I think would show real progress on the ground and would prevent rhetoric from becoming too distant from reality. Mm-hmm. But thus far, you know, the Bush administration doesn't seem to be interested in talking in any way about withdrawal because they're worried that it'll seem to be discussing failure.
Or as you say, benchmarks. Funny you should mention, we have a listener, Roy Fuchs, who listens in Connecticut on SHU Radio. And hearing we were going to talk about this, he writes, we need to set firm, tight, and public benchmarks that drive our policy. And I guess what I'm hearing you say, Professor, is that you don't think this administration is letting us know benchmarks anymore.
The listener is exactly correct that we need benchmarks. And I think that if you look at how public support for the war progressed through 2003 and 2004, from the onset of the insurgency up until the transfer of sovereignty, public support was really sliding in response to the casualties we were taking. But I think by putting out firm deadlines of this is when sovereignty is going to be transferred and this is when we're going to have elections, and actually following through on those deadlines, to the surprise of some people, including, honestly, to the surprise of myself, the administration gained a lot of credibility by sticking to its word. And I think they have an opportunity here to do that again by setting out benchmarks for when different provinces within Iraq will take control. And this allows the turnover of security to be a gradual process by which the American public marks a march toward success.
Should President Bush, in your mind, again, someone who's very familiar with public opinion, should he acknowledge negatives?
I think the evidence pretty clearly demonstrates that the public is willing to forgive mistakes of various kinds if they believe that they're being told the truth. I mean, if you think back again to, say, the Bay of Pigs, where President Kennedy made very substantial foreign policy errors that resulted in really kind of a humiliating disaster for the United States, the public was willing to look past that and move on because they felt like they were in the end told the truth. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of politicians don't give the public enough credit for being willing to listen to the truth and draw their own judgments about it.
And again, as someone who researches public opinion, what do you think about President Bush's continued use of the September 11th attacks to try to shape opinion about Iraq?
Well, I do think that that's something that's been very effective for him. While I think that the real evidence that sort of links the war in Iraq to September 11th is quite thin, nonetheless, the Bush administration has been very effective in linking the two in the public mind through the way that they talk about the war on terrorism. I think that it has been quite effective for Bush. I think that we see once again, for example, the latest polls out in the last couple of days show that the London bombings appear to have given the president a couple of points, you know, 3 to 5 point bounce in approval. And so the linking to September 11th, I think, continues to be something that works for him, whether or not there is real sort of empirical evidence to link the two.
Christopher Gelpy is a professor of political science at Duke University. The White House is said to have drawn on much of his research about shaping public opinion. Professor Gelpy, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, stay with us because there's much more ahead here and now, including the latest from London, where police are now saying they've arrested a suspect in last week's attacks. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. President Bush met today with four senators, two Republicans, two Democrats, to hear their pitches for Supreme Court replacements. After the meeting, the president told reporters he's going to be deliberate in the process of replacing Sandra Day O'Connor, and all four lawmakers said today's meeting was a positive step in a bipartisan direction. Still, hardline conservatives are spending millions to derail the possible nomination of Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, who they say is soft on abortion, and liberal groups are pressuring Democrats in Congress to filibuster anyone who would overturn Roe v. Wade. While speaking to hardliners on both sides, Republican Senator Arlen Specter, chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, had this to say after today's meeting.
I think that the word ought to go out that the special interest groups vastly overstate their influence, that what they are doing is counterproductive and a lot of the times insulting.
Is he right? Is there a center in the U.S.? Well, John Avalon thinks so. John served as chief speechwriter for former New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. He also worked on Bill Clinton's reelection campaign, and he's author of the book Independent Nation, How Centrists Can Change American Politics, and he joins us in the studio. John, thanks for coming in.
Good to be with you again.
When we spoke to you when your book came out, and also during the Republican convention in New York, your premise then was embraced by some others as well, that these center voters were the new soccer mom, that they had the potential to swing an election. And now we've seen those elections, the war in Iraq, the fight over Terri Schiavo, Supreme Court nominees. Is the center thing out the window?
Not at all. I think you look at what the Gang of 14 did, the bipartisan group of senators who got together to stop the nuclear option on the last round of judicial infighting, and you saw guys stand up on both sides of the aisle to reassert the power of the center against both leadership, and the center did hold.
Right. This was seven from each side, Republicans, Democrats, who said, okay, we'll promise not to filibuster if you promise not to get rid of the filibuster, and this was on the circuit court nominees.
That's right, and they opposed the leadership. And the ironic thing here is that in the past, it's been the leadership of both parties who try to assert the power of the center. Now leadership of both parties really represents the wings, the political elites on either side, and it's up to this moderate group of senators who can feel homeless at different times to stand up and represent the moderate majority of Americans.
But isn't there sort of a sticky problem here? American University law professor Stephen Wormiel characterizes it this way. It was thought that Rehnquist was going to retire first and really replacing a conservative voter on the bench, as Rehnquist is, with another conservative voter. And that Rehnquist nomination was going to be a dress rehearsal for the swing vacancy, which Sandra Day O'Connor represents. But as Professor Vermeil says, we've skipped the dress rehearsal. We've gone right to opening night. What potentially happens here? Because now President Bush is faced with this swing voter position.
I think what you're likely to see is President Bush embrace a kind of cosmetic centrism, which has been partly a hallmark of his style since he ran as a compassionate conservative in 2000 in a centrist campaign. He's always been very comfortable articulating the style of centrism, but not so much the substance. So what you might see, especially if we do get a Rehnquist resignation in the coming weeks and it becomes a two-pronged process, is a replacement with a conservative woman such as an Edith Jones, perhaps.
Edith Jones appointed by President Ronald Reagan to the Fifth Circuit?
That's correct. That's one name that's been bandied about a great deal and was one of his father's sort of close list nominees when he ultimately went with Souter. And a Hispanic, but perhaps maybe someone like Emilio Garza, who's more conservative than Gonzalez. So you have the style of centrism, but with conservative content.
Emilio Garza, also a Fifth Circuit judge. So where does that leave centrists, though, if this is just, as you said, cosmetic? Where is the power of the center in this upcoming fracas?
Well, I think it's a number of different places. First of all, it's in the Senate. We saw from the Gang of 14 just two months ago that the center can hold if it's a principled fight against extremes rigging a system. It lies in the voters. We're still a moderate majority in this country, despite the fact that the political elites are controlling the debate. We're a country that's closely divided politically, not deeply divided. I think the president and Congress need to watch out as well. Congress's approval ratings haven't been this low since 1994. American people are getting sick of this blind extreme partisanship. President Bush's approval ratings are low. And if there's a series of conservative judges who threaten Roe v. Wade, watch out. The Republican Party could very easily overplay their hand and alienate the moderate majority of voters who, after all, are the swing voters in this country, just like Sandra Day O'Connor is a swing choice in the court. That's where the real power is, even though things appear so deeply divided.
Polls show that even though people might be personally repelled by abortion, they believe in choice.
That's correct. And there are people reaching out to the center. One thing Democratic Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid said, he called on the example of Earl Warren as the kind of justice who could be nominated. Now, Earl Warren is a dirty word in the name of some conservative circles these days, that he was
because,
in fact, a Republican.
Yeah.
Well, because he presided over a quote-unquote liberal court. But he was a California Republican appointed by Eisenhower. Mm. And he did shepherd through Brown v. Board of Education, which ended segregation, but he did it unanimously. That's a model of a consensus builder, a real uniter and a divider that I think we should be looking to. And when conservatives demonize Earl Warren, I think they need to be very careful about who they're affiliating themselves with. Do they become de facto apologists of segregation?
But what do you say to people, and I'm wondering if you hear from people who say, well, we elected a conservative president, Congress is conservative, we have the right, we won, we have the right to have another conservative voice on the Supreme Court.
Sure, you hear that all the time, but I think what those folks are not keeping in mind is the dimension of the victory. This election was not a mandate for some conservative revolution to roll over the courts in the country. President Bush did win re-election, but with the lowest percentage of the popular vote of any Republican president in American history. This country is not well served by taking a 51% and trying to make it an ideological mandate to ram down the throats of the rest of the country.
And you point out, in fact, that it's not exactly a liberal court as it stands.
That's exactly right. 7 out of the 9 justices are appointed by Republican presidents, and President Clinton's appointees are essentially moderates. I mean, the center of the court has shifted right. But I think the Republicans and conservatives, A, need to be careful about overplaying their hand. The danger of arrogance in this accord not only could really push them back into minority with staggering quickness, but also really look into their hearts and say this is not where the country is. The country is not deeply divided. The elite, political elites and professional partisans are, but the country is closely divided. There's a broad consensus to build off of, and it makes sense and it's right that the justices try to do the same.
John Avalon's book is just out in paperback. It's called Independent Nation, How Centrists Can Change American Politics. He writes about that topic in today's New York Sun. He's a columnist for that paper as well. We can link you to that article. John, you keep pushing for that center. We'll check back with you at the end of the summer to see how you did.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. And tomorrow on Here and Now, the first space shuttle since the Columbia disaster heads for space. What's the program's future? Also, one man's journey into crossword puzzles. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In Afghanistan, a manhunt continues around Bagram Air Base for 4 Arab detainees a U.S. official describes as threats to the global war on terrorism. Rewards have been posted. The men escaped from the prison at the base yesterday, an incident set against a backdrop of continuing violence in the deadliest year yet for U.S. troops since the war began in Afghanistan. Joining us from Kabul, Washington Post reporter N.C. Eisenman. And N.C., first of all, what do we know about the escaped men?
Well, we know that they were all Arab nationals, and they appear to have escaped around dawn yesterday. It's unclear whether they're still on the base or whether they have escaped outside of the base. It's an incredibly guarded facility that they were in to begin with. It's sort of hulking, large structure, and it's in the middle of a very large base where there are thousands of armed U.S. military personnel walking around. It's in a plain that is littered with uncleared minefields, and to get out of the base, there are numerous checkpoints. So it's definitely not an escape that would be easy and does represent a serious setback for the U.S. military.
And see, what is the mood in the country now in light of what seems to be an escalation in violence?
There's a very marked sense of growing sense of insecurity across the country, but particularly in the south and the east and in the capital city of Kabul, where insurgents that are linked to the former Taliban regime that was ousted by U.S.-led forces in 2001 have, since the spring, really mounted a very concerted campaign of terror that has consisted of really daily attacks on military and civilian targets, both foreign and Afghan, and that has really contributed to a sense of instability on a scale that is unprecedented, really, since 2001.
We reported yesterday on the announcement that the body of the 4th Navy SEAL had been recovered on Afghan's border, 2 other SEALs killed, 16 troops killed when their helicopter was shot down. They went to rescue the SEALs. What more do we know about who might have been responsible? Are these Taliban? Are these former warlords who might be anti-Taliban but also anti-American? What do we know?
The possibilities seem to be more either Taliban or Al-Qaeda terrorists or insurgents who are linked to Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who was a former government official in Afghanistan years ago and has reportedly linked up with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. The area that they were operating in, Kunar province, is a place that all 3 of those groups are reportedly moving around in. And the operation that those SEALs were involved in was originally described by the U.S. military as an anti-Al-Qaeda operation. They later sort of scaled back their description of it and were more vague about who exactly they were hunting for. Mm-hmm. And they've also been unclear about exactly who they think fired on those troops. Mm-hmm.
Well, you write today about an upswing in violence by insurgents suspected to be linked to 2 former Taliban leaders as opposed to Al-Qaeda. At least 6 border police officers were beheaded in the southern province you were talking about, a pro-government cleric and his wife killed. How much is the Taliban, again, a force to be reckoned with?
The thing that has really taken people here by surprise, and including people in the military, is not merely the terrorist attacks, which, after all, one can do with a fairly small force, but the Taliban have also shown themselves to be a real military fighting force. In the south and the east, they've had several engagements with U.S. military forces where they've launched ambushes and then been engaged in, you know, hours and hours long firefights. Those firefights have tended to end with very high casualties on the Taliban side, but they are definitely notable in the fact that, that we're talking about Taliban who are moving in groups of 20, 30, 100 or more and firing rocket-propelled grenades, light machine guns, not just small arms, and the fact that they have continued to engage in these kinds of battles even after suffering heavy casualties raises the question of what kind of supply of forces do they have? Do they really have a very large number of men willing to come join them and replace those who are killed? That's still an open question, but that level of fighting and that demonstration of themselves as really a fighting force as opposed to just a small group of terrorists has been a major development out here.
Well, and speaking of the groups of terrorists, Al-Qaeda, separate from the Taliban, hold up on the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. Some say that's where Osama bin Laden is. How large is that Al-Qaeda force said to be or thought to be?
That, you know, that is a real open question, and another big question is to what extent the Al-Qaeda are mixed in with Taliban and are mixed in with even drug lords, for example, who are cooperating with them, and you get a lot of different figures thrown around, you know, by officials. So I don't have an answer to that,
right.
And I'm not sure that that anyone has a real hard answer to that either.
You raise the specter of the third element in Afghanistan, the warlords who control parts of the country and many growing opium. How much ground has been made on that issue?
On one level, there was a lot of progress in that there was a major campaign in some of the areas where there's a lot of drug cultivation in the east in particular. And President Karzai, Hamid Karzai, in the beginning of the year, launched a sort of nationwide campaign to encourage, both using the carrot and the stick, the carrot of international aid and the stick of promised eradication, to encourage farmers not to plant this year. And there definitely was a marked decline in some of these areas in the east, but there was an increase in some areas in the north, and there doesn't seem to be much eradication done in areas of the south where farmers could go ahead and plant. And there, while there have been arrests of small-level traffickers and seizures, it's nowhere near on the scale of the problem.
We're talking to Washington Post reporter N.C. Eisenman. She's in Kabul, Afghanistan. And just from your vantage point, N.C., the U.S. announced yesterday the U.S. military is going to be deploying an additional 700 troops to ensure security for the mid-September legislative elections slated to be held in Afghanistan. 700 troops, is that enough?
Well, certainly I've talked to a lot of people who don't feel that that's enough. They point out that the Afghan National Army, which is currently at about 20,000, is ultimately slated to be many tens of thousands larger, and they're saying, you know, if that's the case, then why do we only have about 20,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan and about 8,000 other international forces if we're saying that, you know, that ultimately the National Army is going to need to be about 70,000. The other difficulty is that, as you know, terrorism doesn't require large forces to be effective. As long as you have a small group that's capable of carrying out daily attacks that really intimidate people, they can have a lot of impact. So that's a big concern out here.
Washington Post reporter N.C. Eisenman speaking to us from Kabul. N.C., thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, still to come, excerpts from today's police briefing in London with news about last Thursday's bus and train attacks. You're listening to Here and Now. It's time to open up the Here Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. After our interview concerning doctors involved in interrogations at Guantanamo Bay, we got a call from Ann Miller of Wayne, Pennsylvania, who was upset that we used the word detainees to describe those who are held there.
I think it's a genteel term that denies the reality they're prisoners and have been for years. I think it's yet another example of how the media and the public in general accepts language that minimizes the realities. And I think by using the terms, those qualities of cruelty are denied.
Our conversation with Stephen Dubner, author of the book Freakonomics, brought a lot of response. Some parents agreed with his argument that car seats for kids over the age of 2 are no more effective in protecting kids than seat belts. But Rebecca Rumpf from Charlotte, North Carolina, called in to say that she uses European car seats for her kids, and she also had this comment.
I'll tell you one thing, that having lost a little brother when I was a child to something that nobody can control and see what that does to a family, I wouldn't want to have, strap my child in with a seatbelt instead of a car seat. God forbid something horrible happens, and there's no way of knowing whether a car seat could have saved them or not, but, it would be a terrible thing to have to live with that question for the rest of your life. So, anyway, thanks for a good program. Bye-bye.
Well, Alice Thibodeau of Scituate, Massachusetts, remembers one type of car restraint she used with her kids.
Around 1969, Sears Roebuck had a special kind of harness that you could use that had a chest plate to it. The kids had to step into it. It fastened in the back, and there was a very wide band of seatbelt material through which you attached the regular seatbelt. And that was what we used for our tools, our children, because there wasn't anything else worked.
Well, we also spoke recently about the real possibility of a worldwide avian flu epidemic. Michael Sisler from Skillman, New Jersey, called with these thoughts.
And I was disappointed that there was no discussion about what we could do as individuals to help protect ourselves. The show seemed to focus on the inevitability of this pandemic and what the government of the world are doing, or more specifically, not doing enough of. And I'd like to know if there is something I can do as an individual to protect myself and my family. Thank you.
Well, Michael, we'll check back in with health expert Lori Garrett and see if there is anything you can do. Our story on the efforts to combat methamphetamine use in rural Colorado prompted this response from listener Duncan Mitchell of Greensboro, North Carolina. He writes, "Doesn't anybody see the obvious parallel between the rise in the use of meth and the sharp decline in the U.S. standard of living, unaffordable health care, dismal employment prospects, and the return of thousands of disturbed soldiers from Iraq? Maybe scholars should be comparing the meth crisis with China's opium addiction epidemic of the early 20th century. Our country is in a very similar period of social decline with inept governance." Well, we also reported last week about a study which showed the most common work conflict was over the thermostat. Amy from Arlington, Massachusetts, has some suggestions for those who are cold at work. She wears a hat and sometimes vests, and
the next thing you can do is just manufacture more heat by moving around a little bit. And I highly recommend in the workplace dancing and jogging and any sort of combination thereof.
How about dancing to Pink Floyd? Finally, pop critic Tim Riley's ho-hum attitude toward the reunion of Pink Floyd at Live 8 brought this response from Angel Pizarro of Phoenix, Arizona. Tim's shock criticism of the band did not do justice to one of the most influential groups of all time. Despite what Riley may think or say, this is a big deal, and I thank you guys for bringing this topic up for discussion. If I hear of another review by Tim Riley of something he hates, I might buy it. As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now.
All hell was just a break in the wall. All in all, it was all just breaks in the wall.
I'm I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, reviewing our top story. Police in London say they've made one arrest in connection with last week's terrorist attacks. The suspect is being brought to London for questioning. Investigators are also focusing on four men who they say traveled to London last Thursday. All four were seen on surveillance cameras, and police say evidence suggests one died on the bus, though it's unknown if he intended to blow that bus up. Here's an excerpt of today's police briefings. First up, you'll hear Andy Heyman of Scotland Yard.
To give us all some idea of exactly what the team have been going through, I'd like to describe some of the activity we've been engaged in. There's been several hundred witness statements taken, over 1,000 different actions being raised, which have been prompted by some very useful and constructive calls from the public to our anti-terrorist hotline. They've been in excess of 2,000. Doesn't that say an awful lot about our communities here in London and around the rest of the UK? In addition, we have seized and started to view over 2,500 CCTV tapes, and they've been urgently viewed for obvious reasons. What I'd like to do now is hand over to my colleague, Deputy Assistant Commissioner Peter Clark, who's head of the anti-terrorist branch, who will go into more detail about the developments of today's activity and the investigation. Peter.
Thank you. As you're obviously all aware, we are conducting a complex and intensive terrorist investigation. And I have to tell you that this investigation is moving at great speed. The investigation quite early led us to have concerns about the movements and activities of four men, three of whom came from the West Yorkshire area. We are trying to establish their movements in the run-up to last week's attacks, and specifically to establish if they all died in the explosions. Today we executed six warrants issued under the Terrorism Act at various premises in the West Yorkshire area. These included the home addresses of three of the four men to whom I've referred. A detailed forensic examination will now follow, and this is likely to take some time to complete. We now know that all four of these men arrived in London by train on the morning of Thursday, July the 7th. We have identified CCTV footage showing the four men at King's Cross Station shortly before 8:30 a.m. on that morning, July the 7th. One of the men who had set out from West Yorkshire was reported missing by his family to the Central Casualty Bureau shortly after 10 o'clock last Thursday, July the 7th. We have now been able to establish that he was joined on his journey to London by three other men. We have since found personal documents bearing the names of three of those four men close to the seats of three of the explosions. As regards the man who was reported missing, some of his property was found on the Route 30 bus in Tavistock Square. Property in the name of a second man was found at the scene of the Aldgate bomb. And in relation to a third man, property in his name was found at the scene of both the Aldgate and the Edgware Road bombs. We also have very strong forensic and other evidence that it is very likely one of the men from West Yorkshire died in the explosion at Aldgate. This, of course, is subject to formal confirmation by the coroner. The investigation is still in its early stages. As and when we find areas where the public can be of specific help, we will, of course, give more information and ask for their help, which we know will be forthcoming. However, I would like at this stage to thank the public for all the support and assistance they have already provided. It is invaluable. At one of the searches in West Yorkshire, some material has been found which has caused the West Yorkshire Police to take measures to ensure that there is no risk to the public. The investigation of what has been found will be a detailed and lengthy exercise. At Luton, a vehicle has been found in the station car park, which we suspect is connected to this investigation. Again, steps are being taken to ensure that there is no risk to the public. One man has been arrested in West Yorkshire and will be brought to London to be questioned. I'm sure you'll understand that in this fast-moving and very complex situation, it would not be appropriate for me to answer questions about other aspects of the investigation. My absolute priority is the safety of the public. We will, of course, give you further information as and when it's possible to do so in the future. Thank you.
That's Peter Clark of Scotland Yard speaking earlier today at their press conference in Britain. British police have arrested one suspect in last week's attacks. And while we're on press conferences, we leave you with sound from a story we've been following about the leaked identity of CIA agent Valerie Plame. White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan was hammered yesterday at a press briefing, reporters asking repeatedly about presidential adviser Karl Rove's role in the Plame affair. In the past, McClellan has said Rove was not involved. Yesterday, he declined to comment. Here's an excerpt.
Scott, this is ridiculous. The notion that you're going to stand before us after having commented with that level of detail and tell people watching this that somehow you've decided not to talk, you've got a public record out there. Do you stand by your remarks from that podium or not?
And again, David, I'm well aware, like you, of what was previously said, and I will be glad to talk about it at the appropriate time. The appropriate time is when the investigation...
Why do you think when it's appropriate, when it's inappropriate?
If you'll let me finish.
No, you're not finishing. You're not saying anything. You stood at that podium and said that Karl Rove was not involved, and now we find out that he spoke about that Joseph Wilson's wife. So don't you owe the American public a fuller explanation? Was he involved or was he not? Because contrary to what you told the American people, he did indeed talk about his wife, didn't he?
David, there will be a time to talk about this, but now is not the time to talk about it.
Do you think people will accept that, what you're saying today?
Again, I've responded to the question. Go ahead, Terry.
You're in a bad spot here, Scott, because after the investigation began, after the criminal investigation was underway, you said, October 10th, 2003, I spoke with those individuals, Rove, Abrams, and Libby. As I pointed out, those individuals assured me they were not involved in this. From that podium, that's after the criminal investigation began. Now that Rove has essentially been caught red-handed, peddling this information, all of a sudden you have respect for the sanctity of the criminal investigation?
No, that's not a correct characterization. And at some point, I look forward to talking about it. But until the investigation is complete, I'm just not going to do that.
That's White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan meeting the press yesterday. We'll continue to follow that story. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.